If you haven't been with us in a couple weeks, or you're new with us, we're doing a series this fall called Origin Stories. And what we're doing is we're going back to the oldest stories in the Hebrew Scriptures and asking, why do these stories exist at all? And why have people felt like for thousands of years now they should retell these stories over and over again? And so this morning we're talking about the flood story, and I want to start right off the bat, boom, open it up by, when I say flood story, what do you all think about? Noah, Texas. That's so good. I mean, why are we laughing at Texas? That's not right. What else? Death. The ark. Good. What's that? Cute little animals. Right. Yes. Rainbows. Unicorns. Doves. Dinosaurs. Okay. Promises. What's that? Fake news. Judgment. Starting over. Yeah. The Cubs. Starting over. Sure. Wipe it out, start it over. We did that many times. It's just worked this time. I was telling somebody this week that I was going to teach the flood, and the person was like, ugh. You mean the story where God wipes out all of humankind? That sounds like fun. Anybody, this is one of those stories. We're not going to read the flood story this morning because it spans Genesis chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9. And if I did that, then we would be done and just move to communion and we wouldn't get to say anything else. But how many of you at some point in your spiritual journey, if not presently, have some issues with the flood story as it comes to us or as you've heard it taught? Yeah, there's quite a few of us over time when we start thinking about, like, I think for many of us, the introduction to the flood story probably came in a Sunday school class setting or in a nursery setting, and it was cute furry animals and all that stuff. And then at some point along the way, something flipped in us and we started thinking about like this picture, right? Which is a wood carving and somewhere by somebody, real specific. But we started thinking about the reality of if we take this story at face value, then God decided one time that he was going to save like a handful of people and wipe out the rest of civilization and didn't seem to have much problem with it, which makes some of us have a problem with God at some level. And so a couple years ago, I taught this flood story, and I was going to skip it in this series just because 3 years ago I taught the flood story. We did a series 3 years ago called Sunday School Stories. And when I did that, we talked about the Epic of Gilgamesh. So for those of you that don't know, let me give you this a real crash course. There are thousands of flood stories in ancient literature. And that's something that we've just, in the last 40 or 50 years with archaeology, we've discovered that almost every culture has some kind of a flood story, some kind of a story about a cataclysmic flood where the world as we know it is wiped out. And the Hebrews are no different. And in fact, when you start comparing the flood story as it comes to us in Genesis, there is a very specific flood story called the Gilgamesh Epic that comes out of Babylon, and which is where the Jews were when they were assembling these stories and assembling the Hebrew scriptures, that there's a lot of like direct overlap between the character Noah, and I think the guy's name is like yeah, I can't remember the guy's name. But the other Noah character in the Gilgamesh Epic, it's UP something. Anyway, there's a lot of overlap and there's a lot of stuff. And so some people, let me just give you the range. Here's what I'm trying to say, is that some people believe this story in a very literal, there was a time 6,000 years ago where there was actually a flood that covered the whole earth and that's what happened. Other people don't quite believe that. Like they believe that this was a story that was told by many ancient civilizations, and what they were each trying to do is they were each trying to put their own spin on this story to explain reality, to explain who they were, to explain who their God was. So for this morning, I just want to say a couple things about that really quickly, and then I want to move past that, is that I don't really care where you land on that. for what we're going to do this morning, it really doesn't matter. And you can, if you want to have an argument with me about it, you can. That's fine. You're always welcome to come in and sit down in my office, and we'll have coffee and we'll argue about it. And I'm totally fine with that. But what we're after in this series is not so much that, but we're really after more of like, but why is this story retold over and over and over again? And so this morning, I'm going to ask you just to set that aside. And I'm going to tell you, I have a bias. I'll just tell you my bias up front is I tend to see this at here. You want to hear my theory on why flood stories exist? Can I give you like a 1 minute version? All right. So 1 minute version is this. Ancient peoples always needed to live near water. There was no Bloomington, Illinois in the ancient world, right? There was no like, hey, let's just build a city out in the middle of nowhere. There was not, that's just not a thing. If you're ancient peoples, you have to be near water. So people would always build near water. They would always build on the banks of the Nile or whatever. And so if you live on water and you live in a time before dams, what happens every year? Floods. And every once in a while, you get a Houston situation and you get massive floods. And if you've never traveled outside of 5, 6, 7, 8 miles of your home, there's these cataclysmic floods come along every so often and wipe out everything that you know. Your whole world gets wiped out by flood. And so I think that at the back, way back, that's how these kinds of stories start getting talked about is why does this happen? Why do these big floods come along and wipe people out? And there's some really great examples, and I could get really dorky into archaeology, but I won't. And so people start asking, and so they use that story, they use their life circumstance to start telling stories, and they're trying to say something about their God or their gods and themselves. So this morning we want to ask the question like we've been asking throughout this series, why does this story exist? Why is it important? And really what I'm really kind of after is, and what I got excited about this week as I was studying is like, why do we still want to tell this story? Because I think for some of us in the room that put up their hands, there's a part of us that wishes this was a story that we didn't tell, that we didn't talk about it. Like if we could just like, I was talking to somebody this week, I can't remember who it was, but we were talking about Thomas Jefferson's Bible. That you guys know Thomas Jefferson like wrote down the stuff he agreed with in the Bible and then just left the rest out, which seems really convenient. And the person I was talking to was like, but at least I respect his honesty, right? Instead of just pretending we believe it all and not really believing it all, like I'm just literally going to cut out the parts I don't agree with and then just read the parts I like. And I think that there's some of us, if we were doing that, okay, let me give you another example. Martin Luther, the reformer, he called the epistle of James a right straw epistle, which back then was like fighting words because he didn't believe it was real. He thought this whole thing about faith without works is dead was a load of straw. And he wanted to cut it right out of the Bible because he just thought it was wrong. And I don't believe in that. And so throughout history, people have said that about the Bible. And I think that there's some of us, if I ask for a popular vote this morning, how many of us wish the flood story wasn't in here? There's a fair number of us that would be like, yeah, I kind of wish that one wasn't there. It's kind of an embarrassment. Like, I don't know what to do with it. And so what I'm really excited about this morning, and I'm taking way too long to tell you all this when I should just be telling you, is that I think this story matters today so very much. It has so much to say about the world that we find ourselves in. So let's go there, right? So one thing I wanted to say the last thing I wanted to do as an introduction before we get there is this. This is from a guy named Pete Enns, who I really like, and he says, together, Genesis 1 and the flood story in chapters 6 through 9 present not a picture of history, but a picture of how Israel sees itself as God's people amid the surrounding world. These early chapters of Genesis are the word of God, but they are not history in any normally accepted sense of the word today, and they are most certainly not science. They speak language altogether. Now, if you think they are science, that's fine. I don't want that to distract us, but I want you to know this is kind of the grid work I'm working through. Some of the things that happen in this passage, the parts that we're not going to read all of it, we're just going to read the beginning and the end. Monday night, I think it was Monday night. We sat down for dinner as a family together. And it gets harder and harder when your kids get older to actually do this, but we've always tried to as much as possible. So we sat down at dinner together. Three of my boys, the two high schoolers, and then Jackson, our middle schooler, had been to an assembly that day. There was an assembly at the high school that they brought the middle schoolers. You did it. You guys went to that? Yeah. And so the assembly was a woman who was a Holocaust survivor. And so she was telling her story at the high school. And so dinner time that night was three of our sons all trying to recount the story of this woman. Have you ever had this happen where three of your kids are telling a story, and how many versions are there among three of them? Four, six. There's a lot of different versions of this story being woven through our dinner table, and a lot of clarifying questions and a lot of arguing about details amongst each other. And sometimes, I'll tell you what scholars say about the Noah story. They will tell you that the narrative feels like that, that what's happening in the narrative is like, there was two of every kind. No, there was two, but seven of some kinds. No, there was two, but seven of other kinds. Or it was 120 days, it was 40 days, it was 20. Like, there's all these details that seem to be woven together that don't quite fit, but they're putting them all in there. And so that's kind of what we have. And so... and some people have tried to harmonize all that, and that's fine too. Let's get to what the story's about. Turn your Bibles to Genesis chapter 6, and we're going to start reading one of the strangest, most bizarre, most perplexing sections of all of Scripture, Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 to 4. And as soon as I read it, I'm going to ask you what you think, and you can say Game of Thrones if you want. When human beings began to increase in number on the earth and the daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown." That preaches, I don't know where. tell me how you hear that story. Lord of the Rings? It feels like Lord of the Rings, right? Do you guys all remember a couple years ago there was a movie called Noah? Is that what it was called? It was terrible. But the Nephilim were these like giant rock creatures. Remember that? Like that was the Nephilim. And I don't remember what the rock creatures did. I just thought it was funny that the Nephilim were rock creatures. There's all kinds of great, if you want to have fun for the afternoon, go look up Nephilim on the internet. There's all kinds of factual stuff there about the Nephilim. That was sarcasm and lots of it. Anybody, thoughts on this part? What do we do with this little section? Cut it out. Chris is over there making scissor figures. Oh, this is one of those ones Thomas Jefferson would have cut out. Any thoughts? It's as if the author, by the way, writing here, isn't even sure what to do with this story. Because there's not like, at one moment, it sounds like it's a bad thing that the sons of God and the daughters of women are getting together. But then there's other moments, it's like these were the heroes. These were the men of renown. And it seems unclear what the author even thinks of this whole situation. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, maybe. It's hard telling. You want to know what some scholars actually think about this passage? Is that this story, these little four verses, are actually borrowed from Mesopotamian and Hittite and Canaanite religions. That they believe that this is what happened in their deep ancestry. And that really that the writer of Genesis, whoever's assembling the story, is pretty ambivalent about that story. But the fact that these stories are popular is a problem for this author. For our author, he's troubled that these stories about the daughters of men and the sons of God cavorting and making giants together, he's bothered that this is a popular story in his time. Because then the next verse, we get to this part. The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe them from the face of the earth. I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them all the animals, birds, and creatures that move along the ground. And I regret that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. So let's back up and talk about the state of creation. All right, we're going to talk about this kind of in three movements. The state of creation. When God created the earth, he created shalom. This is a Hebrew word, and it's not just hello and goodbye, but it is that. But it also has this much deeper sense that shalom is this state of being where there's unity, harmony, goodness, and Sabbath. I'm working right now, by the way, on a podcast series for the fall. We're calling it Imago Conversation Season 2, and we're focusing on the topic of joy. And I interviewed my friend Steve Weens just on Thursday, who just wrote a book called Whole. And he and I spent the first part of the podcast talking about this idea of shalom. It's the sense of wholeness and unity. Do you ever have that feeling like when you've just had, let's say you've had, like there's a state sometimes, like I feel like on a Saturday when I've gotten my chores done and I've exercised and I've hung out with people that I like, and I just feel deeply like satisfied in me, that there's this space of shalom and content and peace and harmony. Anybody feel that sometimes? Right? Like that's, and so that's the picture we get. That's supposed to be the picture we get at the end of Genesis 1 and 2. We're supposed to have that picture that what the garden looks like in that story was this state of unity and harmony with each. I say it this way, like they were at a sense of harmony with each other and with the environment in terms of the garden and with God. That there was just this deep-seated, there's really no great English word for it, except there was just this deep-seated shalom. And so when God looks down on the creation here, we find that it's not shalom. It's that, I like that phrase there. The thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. Now, I'm bad, right? But this is really extreme, right? That my only thoughts are evil. So we understand that the writer's doing a little bit of hyperbole here. I want to read you this quote, and I've read it to you before, but it's really great. It's from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Gradually, it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart and through all human hearts. This line shifts inside us. It oscillates with the years. And even within hearts overwhelmed by evil, one small bridgehead of good is retained. And even in the best of all hearts, there remains an unuprooted small corner of evil. Since then, I have come to understand the truth of all the religions of the world. They struggle with the evil inside a human being, inside every human being. It is impossible to expel evil from the world in its entirety, but it is possible to constrict it within each person. I don't know if you, do you guys all know who Solzhenitsyn was? He was a Russian writer who was imprisoned, I believe under Stalin, and put in the Russian gulag system, and he wrote a book called The Gulag Archipelago. And that idea that through all of us runs evil. There's no one in this room that can sit here and claim like, no, I'm good. Good luck with the whole evil project, the rest of y'all. I've got it. It's all good. And what he's saying is that within all of us, there's this space where there's evil. And that's what happens. So the creation, and just from chapter 1 in this story, Genesis 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, we're at chapter 6. And what God is saying is already that human beings, evil has permeated it all. So I had this image, I had this picture of what shalom looks like, and we're way past shalom now. We're not even hitting close to shalom. We're in this space where their thoughts are evil all the time. Which leads us to the next verse, which is then God's response. The Lord, verse 6, regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. What do you note about the response of God in this moment? Yes. Yeah, that's good. Did you all hear that? That we're let in, what's happening in this story is, by the way, we're not, this isn't God at this really irrational, transcendent level, but rather the writer's letting us know that what's in the heart of God. It's one thing for us to judge each other's actions, but it's another when you hear the heart behind. Have you ever had that happen where somebody does something and you don't understand it? And then when you sit with them and hear like, here was my heart behind what I did. Oh, well, that totally changes. I see it totally different now. And that's what's happening here is the writer's letting us know like, this is what's in the heart of God. Yeah, good. I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. Yeah, everyone is all bad all the time. Noah's perfect. Yeah, right. Sure. And that's where some people say this is a story and stories are told in perfect black and white, perfect hyperbole. You know, like that's where this story really works so well. Yeah, good. Yes. It feels like that a little bit, maybe. Like, you've had your kids, like, maybe one of your kids that's really type A builds something out of Legos, and it's not exactly right, so destroy the whole thing. There's a little bit, maybe, that it feels like that. I want to suggest that what we're getting in this, I want to go land on what Chris was talking about, the idea that we see God's heart here. I think often when we read this story, because of what's going to happen, we see this as the knee jerk, like, I want to wipe them all out. Like, just, I'm angry. I don't know if you've had, you know, we could go to examples, but I don't have time. Where you've had these moments of just like, oh, I was going to do this, and I deeply regret it. Jennifer and I talk about when the kids were really little. I remember when they all got in school. So Maddox was in kindergarten, first, fourth, and fifth, all right? Let's say the kids are that age. And we had this grand idea that Friday night was going to be awesome family night. And the kids would come home from school, and we'd play games and eat pizza, and it'd be all awesome family night. And so we planned the first awesome family night, and I think before it was over, two or three of the kids were crying. We sent them to bed early, and like, no. Because what we learned when our kids were young, especially, is that Friday night, they're freaking exhausted, right? And it's better, like, Friday night should be the earliest bedtime of the week, and then you do fun things on Saturday night when they're well-rested, not on Friday night, which is how many of us feel, right? Like, you get home on Friday night after a long week of work, and like, oh, who wants to go out on Friday night? Or maybe you're a party animal, and, you know, you start on Thursday. This isn't college. You grow up. I was telling Jennifer, she's not in here this morning because she's in the nursery, so I was telling her what I was going to say this morning, and we were talking about this example, and she's like, in those moments, I didn't hate our kids. I didn't, but I regretted that we had set this thing up. This thing, this plan we had, wasn't going to work. And so it required us to, like, and so we release them from it by sending them to bed. We release them from it, and we start over. We go back to the drawing board and say, how do we get the thing we wanted, which is family time together, but this way isn't going to work. And that, I think, is what we're seeing here in this narrative. So, by the way, one of the ways that this story differs from the Gilgamesh epic or the Sumerian flood epic is that this story, as far as I know, the Hebrews, when they told this story, they're the only ones that had a moral cause for the flood. In the other ancient stories, there's no cause given. There's just a flood that shows up. One of the things, and I said this early on, one of the things we want to pay attention to in these stories is how they differ from the ancient stories. And one of the ways this story differs is that it has this whole moral element, which should set off alarm bells on why did they tell this story? Well, they told it differently, and they told it differently because they were trying to say something about the nature of the creation. That this shalom that God had created was broken. And we've been watching that over the last couple weeks, right? So Genesis 1, in the beginning of verse chapter 2, we get the shalom of Adam and Eve, and they were naked and unashamed, and everything was awesome. And then they sinned. And then last week, remember, we had Cain and Abel. Somebody sent me an email this week and said they thought I was talking about a guy named Tim Shell last week, and just had to keep coming back to it's not Tim Shell, but Tim Shell. Never mind. Those of you that weren't here, that makes no sense whatsoever. So we talked about how then this evil then goes to their kids, Cain and Abel. Then right after that, we get to the story of, and it's not only affecting their kids, it's gotten everywhere. It's spread to everything. Everything's bad. And God's response is not anger. It's not wrath. It's simply that God is heartbroken. This thing he had wanted to be so good, this gift he had created, this thing that he wanted for them, it wasn't that. And if you think about the dimensions of sin, I think we could also extrapolate that God's heartbrokenness isn't just because God isn't getting his way, but these creatures who he created for shalom, he created for unity, he created for goodness, are stuck in spaces where it's everything but that. And just think about that for a second, about times in your life where you've been stuck in the darkness, you've been stuck in some bad habits, you've been stuck in some bad place, and it's awful, and it's the opposite of shalom, and it's and then maybe that's your kids or somebody you really love, and you think about how much you hurt for them, and that's what we're talking about, is this heartbroken God who's looking at his creation, and it breaks his heart because he cares so deeply about his creation. Let me just say, this story is completely diametrically opposed to Mesopotamian storytelling about the flood, about deities who are angry or whatever, or whatever's going on in all those. So then that's the setup, and then we get verse 9. This is the account of Noah and his family, and I told you these stories are all kind of woven together, and I want to jump all the way ahead to chapter 8. And I want to start at verse 20. They've come out of the ark. Chapter 8, verse 20. We're all the way to page 6 now. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and taking some of the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, "Never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood. And never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease." So what do you notice about what, let's look at the content of what God says. What is God saying here? What's he not saying? What seems significant, important? It didn't work. What didn't work? Right. So God resets it all. Didn't fix anything. They're still evil. They're still always going to be evil. What else do you notice? Yeah, so there's a line of theology that says God never makes mistakes, or God is the same today, tomorrow, forever. And yet the way the scriptures tell the story is God regretted, and then God changed his mind. Now, I know my Calvinist friends would say, well, God decided way back then that he was going to eventually regret and eventually change his mind. What? Whatever, we can go round and round about this, but I'm just gonna take the story for what it says. What this story, what Israel is saying about their God, how they're trying to make us understand their God, is our God had regrets about how he started the thing, and then he changed his mind about how he was gonna deal with us. That's the story they were trying to tell. I don't wanna get off into the weeds of that whole other thing. Yes. Did you all hear that back there? Peggy was saying, as a parent, when you come in and do scorched earth, any other parents done that? I've done it. How fast does it take you to regret that moment? Like 60, as soon as I cool off, as soon as, maybe not even, yeah, really quickly I'm like, oh, that's terrible. We're taking all your phones away for a month. And they're like, well, but then, yeah, I need you to get home from practice. I need to have you on Find My Friends so I know where you are. I need you to go get your brothers and I can't get a hold of you. Like, this was a bad punishment for me. Yeah, but at a deeper level, at a heart level, not even practical, but a heart level, like, oh. Yeah, see, but the way, okay, I'll just say this, the way I was raised to talk about God, everything you just said is like all my little Baptist fibers in my brain are all like, oh, you're talking about God and you're talking about God changing and God developing and God growing and God learning, and all of that offends all of my Baptist stuff, but it really makes me like God a whole lot more. Yeah, it makes it super relatable. Good. Yes. Does it with Abraham. Yeah, does it over and over in different places. Yes. What's that? Sodom and Gomorrah. He negotiates with Abraham. We see this picture of God. And if this interests you, and you also have Baptist fibers in your brain that are firing, you should read a little bit of Greg Boyd. And if that doesn't mean anything to you, come talk to me afterwards and I'll point you in some directions. All right? Yeah, there's a little bit of a depressing part of it, but there's a hopeful piece, and I want to read to you from the commentary that I was using this week, or one of them. It says this, this is from Walter Brueggemann. "The one-to-one connection of guilt and punishment is broken. God is postured differently. From the perspective of this narrative, there may be death and destruction. Evil has not been eradicated from creation, but we are now assured that these are not rooted in the anger or rejection of God. The relation of creator to creature is no longer in a scheme of retribution. Because of a revolution in the heart of God, that relation is now based in unqualified grace. The first creation ends with the serene rest of God. The recreation ends with God resting his weapon. God's creation is for all time protected from God's impatience. The idea is this, as I think what this story is about and what got me really excited when I started studying this story and like asking this question, like why this story, is that what Israel was trying to say about their God is our God doesn't do tit for tat. Our God does not treat us as we deserve. Our God does not, our God responded once to us in the way that we deserved and saw that that was untenable. Because we would have just had to keep doing floods every time over and over and over again. And the way God chooses to relate to us instead is on the basis of grace. I know they're going to be evil. I'm going to withdraw. I'm not going to, I like this idea of we've been, God is resting his weapon. God's creation is all for all time protected from God's impatience. What makes our God different than the Babylonian deities is he's not capricious. He's not out to get us. It's not one for one, but rather our God knows that we are sinful, knows that we're going to sin, and will continue to pour out his grace to us anyway. And I have no idea what that has to do with today, right? Or our lives. This message then, all right? So let me just frame this real quickly, and then we'll move to communion. Is that what did the story, so how did, you've heard the story, how they heard it then, right? This is how the original writers heard it, is they heard a Mesopotamian story about gods and all the things that we've been saying over the last couple weeks. This story is different. Our God is heartbroken. Our God has changed his mind. Our God is going to treat us with grace. This story gets created way back there. It gets told for generations and generations. And then somewhere in the Babylonian captivity, as they're putting together the Hebrew scriptures, some rabbis say, we're going to put this story in there. And what does that story mean to them as exiles? They're telling themselves, the reason we're in exile is not because God is angry, not because God is mad, not because all these things. Our God continues to treat us with grace, and we will go back to the land because our God, regardless of our sinfulness, will continue to treat us with grace. Which then, move forward to today. I made this mistake this week of doing a search for, how did I do the search? It was something like pastor. I took different events, Orlando nightclub, 9/11, Hurricane Harvey, and then I think I just put the event, and then I said, pastor who said, and that went down a rabbit hole, right? 9/11 is because of abortion, gays, what else? The Orlando nightclub was because of gays, Muslims, Harvey was because, I don't know why Harvey, because of the Astros? I don't know. Listen, if we even followed out the Hebrew scriptures, I know some of you are really good students of the Bible, and you're hearing this and you're saying, wait, Charlie, that might be what the flood story is saying, but there's all these other places in the Hebrew scriptures that say just the opposite, that God does treat us in kind, that there's this contract between us and God. And I would argue with you, again, come in my office for coffee and we'll argue about how even in that contract that we made with God, God was always the one who had to keep fulfilling both sides of the contract, ultimately doing it in Jesus. Like, all right, well, Jesus, I'm going to have to be the faithful human on this contract because they can't even be faithful to this. And so the scriptures over and over are the story of how God keeps on treating us with kindness and graciousness and not in retribution like the flood. And so to me, evil still exists in the world, absolutely. I don't know, Ted, I might even disagree with you about the nature of evil in the world. I see a whole lot of evil in our world. It's really, really ugly in some places. And if you don't know that, you haven't looked enough because it's everywhere and it's awful and it's just, ugh. And yet, I don't believe for any minute that God is orchestrating that. Or punishing this group. A couple years ago, it was the ELCA was having their meeting in Minneapolis, and there was tornadoes, and a pastor in Minneapolis, like, the tornadoes are here to judge the Lutherans. Sorry, Lutherans. Or maybe some of you are quite happy that God was judging the Lutherans a couple years ago. I just want to say, I don't believe that narrative. I believe that narrative that God is punishing with this and smiting them with that is a pagan idea of God, not the God that Israel talked about in their scriptures. that the God Israel talks about is one that doesn't respond to our sin, but always chooses to respond to us in goodness and grace and love. And so no matter what evil it is that we face, no matter what evil that is in us, like Solzhenitsyn talked about, whatever line of evil runs through us, God will continue to reach out to me in grace and love and mercy. We are not being punished. Even if we feel like it, even if we can muster up the evidence in our head, we are not being punished. Evil's real, suffering's real, we're not being punished. Which is really, and I kind of forgot there was communion until this morning, but it's an incredible transition to this, right? That when we come to this table, we don't come because we deserve it. We don't come because, man, this week I really have my stuff together. Sorry. Is that better? Okay, has that been bugging you the whole service? I just noticed and it instantly bugged me. Sorry. Where was I? You can't have the communion center off, the communion table off center. Yes, I was. I was talking about coming with perfection and I looked down and the table was skewed. We don't come to the table in perfection. This is what you do, you pivot. We come lopsided, we come broken, we come with that line of evil right down the middle of us right here, right now, today. Some of us walking down this aisle will think evil thoughts about somebody else in this church. We just will. And yet our God keeps coming to us in the table as a free gift saying, I just want to be reunited with my creation. I want shalom for you. I want shalom inside of you and I want shalom in the world. And whatever I can do to just keep ushering shalom, I'll just keep bringing my shalom. I'll keep bringing it. We're not being punished. I got to tell you, this series to me so far is really, really fun. I'm having a blast because I feel like maybe, I'll just tell you for me, for the first time in my life, I feel like I'm reading these stories and they're super fun and they're super relevant and they're super like, I want to tell the flood story. I want to preach. Like, I got really excited when I decided to preach this and I started like, what am I going to say about this? Oh no. And then I was like, oh, this is the mess. Like, this is good stuff. It's funny, people 6,000 years ago were wrestling with the same stuff we're wrestling with and wondering if we're being punished by God and answering the question, no, we're not. Israel's God always keeps coming to us in grace and love. Let's pray. And while I'm praying, I want the communion servers to come on up. God, be with us in our own struggles. Many of us struggle deeply with the idea that we're being punished. That we don't mean to, but we slip into these pagan ways of thinking where you are smiting and sending hurricanes and tornadoes and floods and all these things. And I just got to say, even just for me, it's a hard journey to let all those things go and to believe that you come at us in nothing but grace. And so help us to receive that. Help us as we come to this table this morning, not to come to in a posture that we somehow deserve, but rather we just receive. We receive your goodness. We receive your love. We receive your grace. We receive your shalom. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.